Les colloques du Collège de France.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and I join those in warmly thanking our colleagues Charpin and Jacquet for this invitation to participate in this marvelous event. The most visible of French Orientalists of the age of au pair, Ernest Renan, once remarked, and I quote, "Les savants en général n'écrivent pas de souvenirs. Ils ont peu à raconter." Perhaps not. None of the Americans who studied ancient Near Eastern languages in Paris during the age of au pair wrote souvenir. So far as I can determine, only one of them, Morris Jastrow, Jr., seen here as a student, attended the lectures of au pair himself. My first question will be, why was it that so few Americans studied what they called Semitics in Paris, the world center of wit, fashion, and learning during the Belle Époque, in contrast to the German universities, where they went by dozens during the same period? It is estimated that over 10,000 Americans studied in Germany during the long 19th century, among them perhaps hundreds of Semitists and biblical scholars, but only a minute fraction of that number studied in France. For langues semitiques and Egyptology, I have found only five. By France, of course, I mean Paris, where at that time nearly all Oriental learning in the country was concentrated, in contrast to Germany, where proud regional traditions supported numerous distinguished universities all over the land. There, Americans often said, wit and fashion were not to be found, but learning was plentiful. Let us choose the year 1888, when Morris Jastrow offered to the American Oriental Society a thoughtful summary of the state of Semitic language study in the United States. He honored the Yale professor Edward Salisbury, whose portrait we see here, as the founder of American Oriental Studies. Salisbury came to Paris in the early 1840s. You see here his passport. He studied Sanskrit and Arabic with Sylvestre de Sacy. Those languages were then seen as the twin pillars of the modern discipline, and he tried to transplant them to the United States. But he was decades ahead of his time in his vision of what American Oriental Studies could be. Although he offered graduate courses in Arabic and Sanskrit at Yale, only two students presented themselves in 15 years, both of them in Sanskrit only. He published assiduously on such diverse matters as Islam, Buddhism, Phoenician, Old Persian, and Sanskrit, but practically no one else knew enough to follow his example. Salisbury's perspective on life in France was mixed. Like everyone else, he greatly admired de Sacy, but he seems to have disliked the French in general. For him, the French had no idea of what he called home comforts, probably referring to French chairs and beds, which are perfectly unsuited to the American physique. The French, he felt, were always too full of their own interminable history. Salisbury complained that they left their homes before breakfast and returned at midnight, gadding about and scandalizing. Ça serait en français vadrouillon et cancanon. They were destitute of the germs of decency. Il leur manque le moindre brin de décence. The last refers obliquely, no doubt, to the proverbial immorality of a great nation. One of the reasons Salisbury had no students was that in his time, Semitic languages had migrated from the colonial colleges like Harvard and Yale to Protestant theological seminaries, so were viewed primarily as training for ministers. That is why, when a German Orientalist wrote a brief account of American Oriental scholarship in 1847, it only took him one page, he saw it as based on and proceeding from biblical study, in contrast to the model provided by the Greek and Latin classics, which were the foundations for much German Orientalist learning of the time. But when Jastrow was speaking 40 years later, in 1885, Semitic languages in the United States were migrating back from theological seminaries to newly founded American graduate schools, so had become a subject of secular graduate study. At the same time, small colleges and seminaries were proliferating. In 1885, then, in the country as a whole, some 125 Christian men were listed as professors of Hebrew. These men, as a group, tended to be deeply suspicious of French scholarship. They would agree with the mid-century Andover Theological Seminary scholar, Bela B. Edwards, who proclaimed, and I quote, "The name of a Frenchman with some persons is a synonym for want of all sound and sober learning," close quote. Biblical Hebrew was the main focus. Arabic, which had been taught in France at a very high level since the reign of Louis XIV, was not an independent subject of study in the United States, even in 1885. Assyriology was an adjunct of Bible study, and Egyptology was essentially non-existent. Jastrow believed that the main problem with American Semitics in 1885 was that there were no collections of original materials in the United States, so Americans could not do original work in the broader field of Semitics outside of the Bible. Like many Orientalists of his generation, he believed that original work meant the discovery, editing, and publication of new sources. Americans were awe-inspired by the vast collections of Oriental manuscripts in museums, libraries, and private holdings in Paris, Leiden, London, Berlin, Rome, and elsewhere. The same was true of Egyptian inscriptions, objects, and papyri, and in due course, cuneiform tablets. The American response was, of course, to start buying such collections and building research libraries. But even 10 years after Jastrow's remarks, such massive purchases had not yet begun in earnest. Here too, Salisbury was a pioneer, buying books, periodicals, and Arabic manuscripts at Paris for Yale. But few were those who actually looked at them. Most Americans simply had no idea of what a great library or collection could be until they came to Europe to study. Now, back to my first question. Why did so few Americans go to France to study compared to Germany? In the first place, German universities had great prestige in American eyes. Emerging American higher education was closely modeled on the German system, and German Oriental scholarship was admired as the gold standard of the profession. The elite of American scholars of the outgoing 19th century, humanists or scientists, studied or took degrees in Germany. As for Syriology, Friedrich Delitzsch, variously at Breslau, Leipzig, and Berlin, was the great teacher of his generation. Americans found him kind, supportive, and rigorous. And you see here a gracious thank you note for hospitality Delitzsch enjoyed in New York, probably hosted by in the New World by former students. He produced far more well-trained Syriologists than any other scholar of his time, though it is noteworthy that few of them were French-speaking. That is because, unless you were a Catholic priest, you had to have studied in France to find your own place in the French system. A great advantage of France to a foreigner was that for any student who just wanted to attend classes or lectures, the constellation of Oriental learning in Paris was unrivaled, including the Collège de France, the École Pratique, the École du Louvre, and the École des Langues Orientales Vivantes, or Langzo, as it was known. At these schools, one could attend lectures or classes without any formalities or fees, just by entering the room as an auditeur libre, or one could register as a student, élève. Therefore, an eager student like Jastrow could get a first-rate Orientalist education without any particular formalities, but, on the other hand, with no documentation and no degree. A doctorate was a complicated proposition in France and was attainable only with two theses accepted at the Sorbonne and not at the other schools. The École Pratique and Langues O could only award a diploma. Another situation peculiar to France was that its institutional libraries, despite their riches, were often very difficult to use or simply closed. This one, for example, you see here, is hardly crowded with users. The leading French scholars thus tended to own magnificent personal libraries that the most generous of them opened to their students. When the American Charles C. Torrey came to Paris in 1895, for example, he found that its famous Bibliothèque Orientale was not only not open to the public, it was never, in fact, open at all. The Arabist Hartwig Derenburg graciously gave him personal access to it so he could carry on his work. It would take an enterprising American with a good command of French to find his way around the Orientalist resources of Paris. We have already noted Jastrow, by far the most cosmopolitan of our American Orientalists in Paris. His background and training are reflected in this ambitious catalog of courses he eventually offered at the University of Pennsylvania. He was born in Warsaw, he came to Philadelphia with his family as a boy, and graduated from the University of Pennsylvania in 1881. As the son of a prominent rabbi and teacher, he was bilingual in German and English and had an excellent Jewish education. After college, he went to Breslau to continue his studies at the Jewish seminary there, a center for what was called Wissenschaft des Judentums, or the modern critical study of Judaism and its key texts. He then went to Leipzig, where he received his doctorate in Judeo-Arabic in 1884 under the direction of Heinrich Fleischer, Germany's leading Arabist. Next, he spent a postdoctoral winter at Paris. At the École Pratique, he took classes in Akkadian with Artur Amiot, including Assyrian and Babylonian royal inscriptions, the Epic of Gilgamesh, and the Sumerian of Gudea. We note that he was a classmate of the Abbé Sauve Plan, author of the first French translation of the Gilgamesh epic. He would also have attended the lectures of Oppert at the Collège de France. Unlike Delitzsch, Oppert seems to have been an intimidating personality. Jastrow also followed classes in Arabic with Hartwig Derenburg at Langues O. Derenburg praised Jastrow, and I quote, as parmi mes élèves les plus ardents. At the École du Louvre, Jastrow studied with Eugène Ledrain, who may have taught him Semitic epigraphy, and at the École Pratique with Charles Clermont Ganneau for ancient Near Eastern art and archaeology. When young Jastrow returned to Philadelphia, he publicly renounced teaching as a rabbi and became instead a secular academic Semitist. The University of Pennsylvania administration seized the chance to appoint him instructor of Semitics in 1885, whence this catalog description, in order to create that new field in the Penn Graduate School. This he did, and added to that a special program in another new field called History of Religions, which had replaced the old programs in Bible study in American universities. According to Jastrow, Derenburg sometimes spoke of American ignorance. This may refer less to their academic knowledge than to American social skills, which usually fell far short of French ideas of etiquette. My second American in Paris is Hallie Charles Haight. He was born in 1863 in Naperville, Illinois, now a suburb of Chicago, then a small town, as you see in this aerial map. He graduated from a business college in Naperville and from the University of Michigan in 1883 with a Bachelor of Laws degree. But instead of settling down to the practice of law in his hometown, he went to Paris, attending courses in Syriac and the history of the Christian church at the École Pratique during the 1885-86 academic year. After this extraordinary detour in his life, he returned to Naperville, where he practiced law for the rest of his life. I cannot account for this youthful indiscretion, except by suggesting that at one point he cultivated most unusual intellectual interests for a small-town American lawyer. My third American student is Isaac Dayton Decker, of Dutch ancestry. He was born in 1844 and grew up in a farm in New Jersey. He entered Yale in 1868 and studied at the Yale Divinity School in 1871-72. Its neo-Romanesque building you see here has long since been replaced by a neo-colonial quadrangle. He was ordained in the Methodist Episcopal Church. After a year's service as a minister, he enrolled at the Drew Theological Seminary in Madison, New Jersey. But then, suddenly, he went to Germany in 1874, perhaps to recover from the heartbreak of the untimely death of his young wife and their infant daughter the previous year. We find him spending 3 years or more at Halle, studying German and teaching English to sustain himself, and surely attending the lectures of Gazanius, along with hundreds of others who filled his lecture hall. Perhaps at Halle he began the study of Arabic. He then came to Paris, surely for further study of Arabic, sustaining himself as a private teacher. He likely learned spoken Algerian Arabic at Langzhou and classical Arabic from Hartwig Derenburg. Decker moved to Algiers about 1887. He lived there the rest of his life, at one time serving as secretary and interpreter for the American consul. Decker died at Algiers and was, ironically, interred in the Jewish portion of the French cemetery there for foreigners, largely having lost contact with his American relatives. This man remains something of a mystery. My fourth American in Paris, William Elliott Conselman, is quite a different story. He was a native of St. Louis, Missouri, born in 1855 and graduated in 1875 from Washington University. His father, Gottlieb Conselman, was an immigrant from Germany who settled in St. Louis and achieved immense success as an investor in real estate. Listed in the 1850 U.S. Census as running a paper store, by the 1880 U.S. Census, he was listed simply as a capitalist, owner of numerous residential and commercial properties throughout the city, with additional buildings elsewhere, including the up-and-coming city of Los Angeles. Young William was, therefore, a fine specimen of the wealthy young Midwestern American of the Belle Époque, as we read about in the novels of Henry James, though his intellectual interests by no means fit that pattern. He may well have grown up with a speaking knowledge of German. Indeed, St. Louis had a German-speaking population large enough to support several German language newspapers. One might have expected, therefore, that he go to Germany to study, but instead he chose France. Conselman came to Paris about 1890 and studied at the École Pratique. Although he took classes with the Assyriologist Arthur Amiot, his principal teacher was the Semitist Joseph Halevi, who initiated him into Ethiopic studies. Ethiopic began at the École Pratique in 1881 with three students, one of whom was a certain Alat de la Furia, Capitaine du Génie, who is well known to Assyriologists for his interest in the early dynastic tablets from Tello. The school proclaimed particular pride at the appointment of Halevi to its faculty. On the basis of Conselman's dissertation, an edition of the Chronicle of the 16th century Ethiopian Emperor Gelawdewos, the supervising faculty, Halevi, Auguste Carrière, and Joseph d'Ehrenburg, certified him as an élève diplômé on January 8, 1893. From the printed version of his dissertation, which appeared as the 104th volume of the Bibliothèque de l'École Pratique, it is obvious that not only was he an accomplished scholar of Ethiopic, he had also learned French well enough to write a substantial scholarly treatise in that language. In August 1898, Conzelman applied for a U.S. passport at Paris because he wanted to travel east, meaning to Egypt. But misfortune struck him in the prime of life. In December 1898, we find him drawing up his last will and testament in the presence of the U.S. consul in Cairo. From this document, we learn that he had inherited 5 properties in St. Louis with 8 buildings on them, and was owner or joint owner of 4 additional properties with 6 more buildings, including 2 stores. His net worth in notes and stocks alone, quite apart from his real estate, was well over $90,000, which is probably the equivalent of about $30 million today. Therefore, this young Semitist had no financial worries and never needed any sort of salaried employment. We hear of him again in the summer of 1900, drawing funds at London and Berlin. But whatever the nature of his illness, perhaps tuberculosis, the end was near. He died September 2nd, 1900, at Falkenstein, a spa town in Hessen near Frankfurt. My last American of the au pair era, Charles E. Wilbur, a native of Rhode Island, came to Paris for quite different reasons. He wanted to avoid going to prison. 30 years older than the other Americans in our group, he acquired a law degree, worked as a newspaper man in New York, and owned a paper mill that enjoyed the patronage of the all-powerful and notorious New York Irish political boss, William M. Tweed. Like everyone else associated with the Tweed ring, Wilbur prospered from the monstrous corruption and thievery that Tweed presided over. But in 1871, Tweed's luck turned against him, and he fell as far as he had risen. It was soon thereafter that Wilbur departed for Paris with a full purse. There he was captivated by the Egyptologist Gaston Maspero. He spent his remaining years in the comfort that his wealth provided him, dividing his time between Paris and Egypt, whereas Boss Tweed died of pneumonia in a New York jail. Wilbur maintained his own Nile houseboat, pictured here on his visiting card, and amassed a large collection of Egyptian antiquities and a superb library that eventually became the pride of the Brooklyn Museum. But despite his knowledge of the field, he never contributed a publication to Egyptology. He was always the erudite amateur. In deference to Assyriology, we should mention Stephen Langdon. He and the Arabist William Popper belonged to the next generation of Americans who studied in Paris in the early 20th century. A native of Michigan, Langdon studied in Paris during the years 1904 to 1906 under Vincent Shale, who had succeeded to the chair at the École Pratique, and the great Théodore d'Angin at the École du Louvre. As for all of those Americans who chose Germany over Paris, may I conclude with a remark of the late Maurice Lambert, also of the École du Louvre. When once I asked him if he planned to attend the upcoming Rencontre Assyriologique in Leiden, he said, "I live in Paris. Why would I go anywhere else?" Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-2-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.